Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 5th of February, Anno Domini 2011, and you, oh, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Dennis Worcester.
And at 3 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, stuff to use, things to choose, nothing to lose.
You did that very well.
Thank you. Steve is one step ahead of the law somewhere in the Midwest.
Or turned into a Trekkie.
And Dennis has kindly consented to take his place.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah, no. Glad to have you.
Is his mic up?
Yeah. Can anybody hear me? Raise your hand if you can hear me, everybody.
There we go.
Thank you. Hands down.
I can't hear some. I can't hear anything, apparently.
Well, I got him up. He's a little... Go ahead.
Am I the low talker?
Yeah, you're the low talker, and I'll bring... I'll bring you right on up.
Okay.
Usually Steve is like, boom, there he goes, off the wall.
All right, this is a little better. All right, we'll start with our big news of the week. Google has run a sting operation that it says proves Bing has been watching what people search. It's the Bing sting, what people search for on Google, the sites they select from Google's results, and then using that information to improve Google's own Bing's own search listings. Bing doesn't deny this. Google essentially took a bunch of nonsense and misspelled words and phrases and jiggered their search engine to specifically return certain results, some of which actually have no relation whatsoever to the search term. They started this on December 17th. By December 31st, the exact same results started appearing on Bing, and Google started monitoring and documenting that. As a result of the apparent monitoring, Bing's relevancy is potentially improving on the back of Google's own work. Google likens it to the digital equivalent of Bing leaning over during an exam and copying off of Google's test. I've spent my career in pursuit of good search engines, said Amit Singhal, a Google fellow who oversees the search engine's ranking algorithm. I've got no problem with a competitor developing an innovative algorithm, but copying is not innovation in my book. Bing doesn't deny Google's claim. Indeed, Stefan Weitz, director of Microsoft's Bing Research Engine, seems to confirm the allegation. I won't bother to read this because it's irrelevant. What it basically says is, yeah, it's kind of what we do. except he calls it a hack. Well, he calls the Google experiment a hack to confuse and manipulate the result and the facts. And Google says it's not a hack, but a way to prove that Bing is copying their results. Basically, of course, the idea behind this is that you go to a search engine because it brings you the most relevant results.
Right.
And if you're going to Google or to Bing, you go there because you believe they're going to bring you the same results. Well, clearly Bing apparently thinks that Google's results are better, and they're stealing them. And Bing's not denying this. So, okay, I guess Google wins. Our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. Google says Bing copies their search results, and your choices are, I have never trusted Microsoft, I have never trusted Google, and I have never thought about it. So far, we have 34 votes, and I'm delighted and shocked to say that I have never thought about it is only second. only two people don't trust Google. Most of you, the majority of you, don't trust Microsoft, which is pretty interesting. Now, I cannot imagine you don't have more to say about this. So what you need to do after you've made your vote choice is to look at the yellow box underneath the poll. Click on the link, give us your opinion, and it will take you to my website, AskNick.com.
That's AskNick.com.
And you will see the poll of the week, which is, do you trust Google or Microsoft more, and why? And so far, a half a dozen of you have answered, some of which actually has something to do with the question. And when you're done with that, give us a call. Do you think Microsoft is in fact copying Google's results? And is that good? Well, we already know that. I shouldn't even ask that question because Microsoft admitted it. Is that fair play or is it cheating? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll free 1-800-790-0415. What do you think, Dennis?
I don't know, man. If Bing is grabbing those results and treating them as if they were their own work in any other...
And that is what they're doing.
In any other environment, would that be considered right? I mean...
Well, certainly you would, you know, if you were right, if you were doing it in a classroom test environment, it would be cheating. If you were doing it on an academic paper of some sort, it would be plagiarism. So what is it on the web? Is it okay suddenly when you put it on the web?
If you're in the private sector, I don't know. I think they've got rules against that sort of thing, though.
Yeah, you would think they would.
One brief moment here I want to just interject in case folks are trying to look for us up on the web, speaking of the web,
yes,
doing the stream. We're not here this week.
Right. We're not on Ustream this week. Because Steve is somewhere in the Midwest, one step ahead of the law.
And he took the camera.
And he took the camera with him, apparently.
So maybe we'll see film?
Maybe he's streaming.
That would be the thing now. See, this is the thing we got to look for is hopefully Steve is streaming the high-speed chase.
That is it. And, well, surely I'll have the camera on him.
Right. Actually, my hope is he's not somewhere in the Midwest because I believe they're still pretty well socked in.
Yeah.
And might not be a good idea.
Really something, though. You know, talk about computers and everything else. And I got to admit, one weather person here in the city did retract his statement, you know, of, oh, it's going to be a bad blizzard.
The snowpocalypse.
Yeah, that Thursday, Tuesday.
Snowmageddon, all that nonsense.
What was it, Monday night?
Right.
Yeah, he sat there and he retracted what he said. It could all of a sudden shift. I mean, meanwhile, they had everything closed, canceling this, canceling that. I get up at 7 o'clock in the morning figuring, all right, I got to sit there and snow blow because it's going to be a horrific day. They're saying all the snow now. I get up, I look. It's a major non-event. It's like, hello, you better readjust your computers.
Back in the 70s, there was a day when they predicted the wall of snow. The wall of snow was coming from Buffalo.
Yep.
Okay.
Right? And it was going to come through us. And Buffalo had already gotten, like, I don't know, 82 feet of snow or some number, whatever the number was. But it was huge, and it was terrible, and it was this wall of snow advancing east from Buffalo. So, you know, I was actually part of a resident theater company at Nazareth College at the time. So everything got canceled. The place got shut down. We all went out to Wegmans and spent all our money on beer and pretzels. And
what?
The essentials.
Unbelievable.
How could this be?
We then sat in the lounge. We rearranged all the furniture so we were looking out a west-facing window.
Way to do it.
You know, and we're just sitting there waiting for the snow and waiting for the snow and waiting
for the
snow.
Nose up against the glass.
Yeah, we're just sitting there waiting. It's better than television. And it's green and there's birds. There wasn't a bit of snow on the ground anywhere. And we waited for like 2 or 3 hours, and finally the radio says, well, it seems to have, it went north. It turned north, and we never got it. And at that point, there was zero snow on the ground. So we got some, at least. And I actually gave my guys, I told my guys, work from home.
Yeah.
That day, because the thing I had heard that the night before was, well, there's not only going to be a lot of snow, but then it's going to turn into sleet and ice, and that's going to cover it. And the roads are going to be really horrible in the morning.
Sure.
And, you know, I don't want my guys dying on the road to work because, you know, it's paperwork. So I told them, you know, work from home. And then, of course, I called them up in the morning and said, well, you guys are coming in, right? And they went, huh?
Huh? What?
No, already been working from home. 3 hours already, boss. Not a problem.
As far as you know.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Oh, one other thing that I want to mention. I just found this out this morning because I don't mind being the guinea pig. But you folks on Facebook, there's a spammer going around that, you know, it's an app that do not install that's saying, oh, do you want to see who's snooping on you?
I've seen this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it is really gaining momentum, and all I can tell you folks is please do not click on it. Do not say yes and have it check and all this other stuff. It is spamming, and like I say, I don't mind being a guinea pig. You know, that's what I do for a living. You know, test out stuff and that. And this just happened to be another one that's out there. And if you do by accident get into it, what you have to do is go into your Facebook settings, go into your account, and I believe under the privacy, you'll see where you can edit your apps. And under the apps, you can open that up and then delete that one. Who's spying on me?
Right.
Okay. So you can get rid of it. And it's definitely one you do not want. No way, Jose.
Right. Well, my favorite part is now what Zuckerberg is trying to do. And this is actually a story for later. But what Zuckerberg, the guy who runs Facebook, is doing now is if you like something or follow something, like, you know, you say, oh, I'm a fan of Coca-Cola or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Now they will put ads on your friends' pages with your face in it for Coke.
Oh, jeez.
As if you were endorsing a product.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I immediately unliked almost everything.
Right.
That's first. And then secondly, there's no way to opt out of this.
Ouch.
So I'm waiting. You know, I endorse products. I make my living as a public figure. And,
sure.
And so if they try to use my image to endorse something without paying me, my lawyer will call them.
Sounds reasonable, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. It's just the way that works.
All right. The other thing I want to remind folks and get into right now is, you know, we got an event coming up, March 12th. And unless you've been living under a rock and haven't been listening to sound bites, and I don't know why you wouldn't be doing that, you got to set March 12th aside. Because we got a little friendly competition going on here, folks. We're going against the polka dots. And we're trying to see how many tickets we can sell versus them. So when you call and ask for tickets, make sure that they... Because, you know what? It's an event you're not going to want to miss.
What could this event possibly be?
It's going to be a pancake breakfast. All the pancakes you can possibly eat, coffee, juice, and guess what?
It's got to cost $50.
Nope.
Oh, at least.
Nope. For a breakfast, all-you-can-eat pancake breakfast?
Nope.
It must cost $50.
$5.
$5?
$5.
American money?
Yep. And you're going to be entertained. From 10 to 12 will be the Polka Guys doing their show live in the cafeteria. I want to stress this. It's in the Greece Olympia cafeteria. So, you know, there's going to be plenty of parking. Nothing going on there that you'll have trouble finding the spot. No, you're not going to have that issue. And it's indoors. So, you know, if who knows what the weather is, you know, if it's snowing, we don't have to worry about it. Again.
Hold on. All the pancakes you can eat.
Mm-hmm.
All the juices and stuff you can drink.
Yep.
Breakfast meats, too?
Yes, breakfast meats as well.
All right.
Polka music from
all
10 to 12.
All the polka you can hear, yeah.
Sound bites from 12 to 2. Kids 5 and under eat for free.
But
and how much does it cost again?
It's only $5, and it's only running from 10 to 1.
Right. You can't come in after 1.
Yeah.
We'll be there till 2. You can sit and listen.
I mean, come in, but you won't get any food at all.
Yeah, you stop serving at 1.
Yeah. So, but, you know, definitely mark down on your calendar. You can also call the station and, you know, reserve your tickets. Now, again, they're only $5. If you call 585-966-2660, or I believe you can also get them on the web. Yeah, online. You can also reserve your spot and pay for it right there online. And it is secure, so you don't have to worry about somebody getting in there, hacking your, you know, identity or anything else. But it's an event, folks. We love, you know, getting out there and, you know, seeing the, you know, the folks that listen to our show all the time, meeting and greeting them. We'll be answering questions. So please save the date and show up.
And please remember when you call in, ask them to put that yellow stripe on it. Tell them it's for sound bites. Or if you do it on the web in the comments place, say it's for sound bites.
Oh, one other thing I forgot. Laura Lynn is going to have some and Robert. Cooking up some giveaways.
Ooh.
Holy mother of pearl. So it's not just free food, great entertainment, all for only $5.
When is this happening?
March 12th.
March 12th.
From 10 to 12. Well, actually from 10 to 2, but the pancakes will only be from 10 to 1.
We're serving from 10 to 1.
We'll might
be on the air from noon to 2.
Be in the kitchen.
We'll be in the kitchen in the
flipping
morning
pancakes.
Flipping them flapjacks.
Yep.
So we'll be flipping flapjacks.
You guys are signing autographs at the event, right?
Oh,
we'll be in syrup.
Nice.
On the pancakes.
Well, that you can't lose it. Cool. It'll stick right to you.
I can do my D.
Nice.
As long as it's slow-running syrup.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're right, it out a little.
Yeah, you get some of them that's so watered down, it's like, you know.
We wouldn't have that. We won't have that. No. Clearly not. That'll be not us. So yeah, give us a call about that. And you heard Dave give you the number. You can do it securely online at jazz901.org. Of course, you can give us a call with your computer questions at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free. 1-800-790-0415. And if you are shy or you think of a question in the middle of the week that you want to get to us, well, you can even send it to us online. Just go to soundbites.org and click the link and send us your question.
I'm going to put in another shameless plug while you're grabbing another news item there. This Thursday, if you're not doing anything, folks, if you would, I invite you to join me Thursday night from 6 to 9 as Rob's turning me loose again in the studio and playing my kind of jazz. So, you know, all you folks, if you get a chance, please, I'd love to hear from you on Thursday night. We do take requests, and I'll be here this Thursday from 6 to 9.
All right.
Great.
Here's an email message, Joel from Pittsburgh. Writes, tried to call this in last week, but got cut off at the end of the show. Yeah, we tend to, like, now there's not very many people calling in, and at the end of the show, the lines are backed up, and we don't get to everybody.
Well, folks go, oh, wait a minute, Sound Bites is on.
Call early. Call early and often. It's Chicago-style phoning in. I was able, he had a question about moving his mail from Mac Mail to Outlook 2010, and the way he ended up doing it was creating a Gmail account, a Gmail IMAP account.
Mm-hmm.
And using that for the transfer. So he transferred it all up to Gmail.
Right.
And then transferred it back down again, which is one of the things I think we suggested.
Yep, you can do that. That's free. So. It takes a little bit longer than doing it directly on your local computer because you've got to push all the mail out to Google servers and pull it all back in. But it does work, and the price is right if you've got time.
Right, right. I know a lot of people are using Google as their mail system.
Sure.
You know, you get 7 gigs of storage.
Mm-hmm.
God knows they're backing it all up. And
there's another tool for the Mac called Email Chemi. It's by a company called Weird Kid Software. And I think it's about $25. And it will convert just about any mail file into just about any other mail file. It's native on the Mac. And it's a great tool. I've used it for clients over and over again. It's paid for itself many times over.
What's the name again?
It's called Email Chemi. It's like
got it. Email Chemi.
It's like alchemy, but with email.
Yep.
So you can hit that up on Google. Just search for Email Chemi, and you can pull that up. It's a great tool.
Nice. All right, we're gonna go to the phones now. Our first caller is Tom from Penfield, New York. Welcome, Tom. What's your question? Tom, are you there?
Hear me, huh?
No, there you go.
There he goes.
Okay, here I am. I've got.
I forgot to push the buttons again.
Twice.
My own button, too. Jeez.
All right, go ahead, Tom.
I'm new at this.
I've got a couple laptop computers. I've got one that's Ubuntu, and the other one's a MacBook, and I'm on a wireless network. And I've got a Linksys a wireless router that's a 54G, I guess it is. But I set up the network a long time ago, and it's just called Linksys.
Okay.
So when I go and look at the listing of available networks, I get a Linksys with a lock on it, which has a strong signal, and then I get a Linksys without a lock on it that's got a weak signal. And there are other networks in the area that I can see pop up once in a while, but I'm just wondering if the Linksys with the low signal on it is any kind of security threat to me, or you know, why am I seeing it in here, I guess.
Right. All right. We're going to answer that question, Tom, but we're not going to answer it right now because we have to take a quick break. So you stay on the line, and when we come back from this very short break, we will give you the answer to your question. And, of course, we'll take all the rest of your questions at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free at 1-800-790-0415. For Dave, for Dennis, I'm Nick. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with a whole lot more sound bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Dennis Worster.
And at 25 minutes after the hour, we have Tom from Penfield, New York, on the line. Tom, you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay, here's the deal. When you put up a Linksys router, the name it has is Linksys.
Linksys.
And if you don't change that, that's the name it puts out. So what's likely happening is that your strong signal is your Linksys router.
Okay.
You have a password on it?
Yes.
He can go in and edit it. I mean,
well, hold on a second. The one that is the weak signal without the lock is somebody else in your neighborhood.
Oh, okay.
I was once at a friend's house, and there were 7 Linksys signals.
Oh, okay.
What your best bet is to go into the router itself, and you know you do that through the web interface.
I did that a few days ago. I changed the name.
Yep.
And then when I got back in, I messed up my, I couldn't print any longer. So I still had the Linksys with a low signal when I changed the name of the Linksys with a lock on it. And then I messed up my printing, so I kind of gave up on that and went back and renamed it back to Linksys and then got my printing back. But changing the name of it didn't get rid of the low power.
I bet your laptop's trying to
connect
to the old one.
It doesn't know any better.
Yeah. You'll never, ever get rid of the one with the low signal because that belongs to someone else in some other home.
I was concerned it was mine and somebody could get into it. But
Tom, what it is when you're hooking back up, you know, and you change the name.
Yeah.
On that one that was wireless, what you have to do is go in and say, find network connections. And then you have it refreshed. You'll see the new named network that you just put out there. And
okay,
that's locked down.
I did see it. I had the new name network, but then I couldn't. I got a wireless printer, and I couldn't print. And it took me, I went several hours trying to get printer to work.
Yeah, because in there, you also have to have it rediscover the network.
Yeah, and I couldn't get to the point where I could do that. So I finally gave up and went back to the old Linksys name so I could get my printing back again.
Yeah, but that's what it's going to take is you need to go into the menus of your wireless printer and have it research. It'll search the network and refine your new named network.
Right. Right, but where I am right now, it's everything's working, and as long as there's not a security issue, I'm okay where I am, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
You just, like Nick said, you just look for the one that's the strongest, and then it's locked down.
Well, that's the one that has a lock on it.
Well, like Nick, I was over to a client. And I discovered there was 6 people within the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And she couldn't get, she goes, I forgot my password. That's why, because I just had to quick grab a file. And no problem. There was, 5 other folks in the neighborhood, all not locked down.
Right.
Yeah. I grabbed the fastest, the biggest signal. Boom. Quick downloaded the file.
Well, sometimes I can see about 6 other available networks here, but they've all got locks on them.
Right. That's good.
And that's the way it should be.
Linksys doesn't have the lock on it.
Guy named Randall Monroe creates a web comic called XKCD. And if you went to xkcd.com/466, he has a comic there. And if you hover over it, you'll see the alt text pop up. And it says, we need a special holiday to honor the countless kind souls with unsecured networks named Linksys.
It's a national wireless ISP.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just travel around your neighborhood and look for them.
But would you have time for another question?
Very quickly.
I do the Linux Tango.
Right.
I got my computer set up for that. But I did a virus scan this morning. Had no viruses. But I also did the RK Hunter. And I'm coming up with 9 suspect files and 3 suspect applications and 0 possible rootkits. So I'm running RK Hunter 1.3.4 and
I think 1.3.8 is the latest.
You know, I can't figure out how to update past 1.3.4. I do an update, RK Hunter --- update, and it goes through something, but it doesn't. How do I update to the latest version of RK Hunter?
Which version of Ubuntu are you running?
I'm on, I think it's 9.1. It's Karma Koala.
Yeah, you have to up. They'll only go so far. Mm-hmm. I'm running, in fact, 10 point. I don't even know which version I'm running. Hold on. This will tell me in a minute. But I think I'm running 10.04, I think.
Yeah.
And my version of RK Hunter is at 1.3.6.
Okay.
So I'm a little behind, too. You have to go up to the latest version, really, because as they add new things, some of it they'll do, some of it they'll update, but often you're a little bit behind.
I was going to wait to go until I stop supporting 9.1, until I go to the next version.
Right.
I was just wondering, I mean, the files that I've got that are suspect, and then these, I always get the same applications that are the same three that are always flagged. I don't know if it's like a false positive or not.
Right. Probably a false positive. What happens is one of the things that you need to do is update RK Hunter whenever you add a new program.
Okay. I just updated it today and then reran it, but I've still got the same issues with the suspect files on it. So,
Do you know the names of those files?
I can look them up. Yeah, I can go up here.
Not right now. I think we kind of have to move on. But
okay, they're all under bin. They're like a DMSG, MORE, MOUNT. I've got the sudo and DP.
Well, mount and more are definitely part of the system. What's likely happened is they upgraded.
Okay.
And after the upgrade, Rootkit Hunter didn't know that you had updated them.
An upgrade came through earlier today. I did that, the upgrade, before I actually ran RK Hunter.
Well, no, in addition to that, whenever you do an upgrade or add a new piece of software,
right,
you want to run as root, sudo,
mm-hmm,
RK Hunter space --update.
Update, okay. Yeah, I did that before. And sudo is always is also one of the ones that's coming up with a warning here.
Right, and then after you've tried to update itself, then you do it again, sudo rkhunter --propupd, prop update. I don't know what that actually stands for.
Yeah.
And that will compare property updates, and that compares the properties of the various commands. And that will actually update its understanding of what files you're running.
All right, I'll try that then. I'll run that next and see what happens.
And you should always make that part of what you do after you do an update or an upgrade or after you install new software.
Okay.
Okie doke.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Absolutely my pleasure.
Guys, I wanted to do a quick plug if I could. We've got a Apple user group here in town. And if you are an Apple fan, if you've got a Mac or an iPad or an iPhone or an iPod Touch, and this is something you're really into, and you want to learn more about it, you can always come out to our monthly meetings. We meet over at East High at 7 p.m. And this month, we've got actually a special guest that we are doing a remote video conference with. It's going to be Chris Breen, who is a senior editor at Macworld Magazine. He's going to be talking about things that you can't learn at the Apple Store.
Nice.
So, be
and where is that and when?
That's going to be at East High, which is on East Main Street. And it will be at 7 p.m. in the forum room.
So, what door do they go in for that?
it's the northeast door. It's the old bus loop that they can come in. And it's right outside the forum room there, and straight through the doors and make a left. So
what is that, Ohio Street?
I believe that is right.
Yeah, they go in the Ohio Street entrance.
Yeah, so come on down, free. Come on down and see what you can learn and hear all about that and more.
You folks out there may know that I'm not a Mac fanatic, but the Mac meetings are always fun. They're always fun. They're always interesting. I don't remember if I was ever president. Oh, yeah, I was. I was president of the group. I was never treasurer. I was president. I was vice president. I was librarian.
Right.
Back in the day when I wrote an entire HyperCard application to run the library. It was great. People would give me their money. That was back in the day when you didn't get stuff from the web because there was no web.
Right.
And if you wanted stuff, we had it. Yeah, you got it.
Sneakernet, yeah.
Right, Sneakernet. So people would we had forms. You'd fill out the form and give me the money, and I would go to my little HyperCard application, and I would say, give me a disk of this and a disk of this and a disk of this.
Uh-huh.
And it would tell me, put in a disk and put in a disk and put in a disk, label it this when I took it out, and I was done.
Yep.
I wrote all that in HyperCard. I loved HyperCard.
We're going to do all
dumbest
of those
thing
things.
Microsoft ever did, or Microsoft. The dumbest thing Apple ever did was get rid of HyperCard. I loved
HyperCard. I would love to see HyperCard come back, especially as, and there have been other programs that have come around since then, things like HyperStudio and a number of others that have essentially mimicked what HyperCard can do. But I would love to see it as a kind of low-impact development environment for kids, especially to develop your own iOS apps, just stuff that you're going to use on your own machine. Things like Xcode, learning Objective-C, that's a pretty steep road to try and build your own apps just for fun for yourself.
It would seem to me that one of the things that made Microsoft as ubiquitous as it is that it came with BASIC. Apple II came with BASIC.
Right.
They sold a gazillion of them. Were you ever going to be a real heads down all day long programming guy, a code monkey? No, but you could program stuff if you wanted to, and that's really all that counted.
Right.
And the same thing with every other that came along until Apple, when suddenly they got rid of HyperCard. Apple BASIC never came out. All the easy stuff was gone. Suddenly you had to be a C-sharp programmer or a Pascal, I suppose, programmer. I mean, there was just a lot of stuff that you had to do to be that programmer rather than, something as easy as BASIC.
It was the kind of thing where you could scratch your own itch. If you had a specific need for something and it was not too involved, you could kind of build something yourself and kind of learn how to do that and learn what it takes to do that well, which, was kind of a iterative process for a lot of us. But you could build it yourself and you could feel, a sense of pride. And right now, you can either go download an app that somebody else built that it wasn't you, that never interviewed you to find out what you needed specifically, or you can pay money and have something built custom, but you're going to pay through the nose for that. So, yeah, I would love to see a development environment that was easier to use. And I think Google is starting to do that for their Android phones, aren't they? They've got a simple...
Yeah, there's a real simple app. It doesn't do a lot yet, but they're building it up and building it up. It's the app. I forget. I'll think of it in a minute.
Something like Sugar or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Now, Sugar is... Well, yeah, but I'll think of it in a minute. But the point is, yes. And so if you... I would love to see something as easy and as useful as HyperCard that was available for web development as well as app development, whether you're on an Android phone or an iPhone or in the Chrome browser. You know, the ability to be able to create an app simply and easily. Would you get a lot of crap? Yes, absolutely would. So what? You'd get some interesting stuff. You'd get some gems.
You don't know until you try.
Right. And if it's open source, you can fool around with it because the nice thing about things like HyperCard is they were really, really easy to learn and understand.
That's true. Right, yeah. Now you're stuck with Java or Flash, both of which are better than having to learn Objective-C.
Yeah,
but
certain select values are better.
Yeah, but still, it's not the kind of thing you can pick up over a couple of evenings. You know, the way you could do with HyperCard. HyperCard was just literally a digital representation of a stack of index cards, and you put a button on it that jumped it to a next card, and it made kind of a rudimentary database. You could do just about anything with it.
Yep. I really liked HyperCard. I really liked the ease of use. And I'd miss it. I wish there was an open source alternative for Linux, if nothing else. All right, we are going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Dennis Worster, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 39 minutes after the hour. You continue, for no discernible reason, to be listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites on the truly great, member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Dennis Worster.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. That ad for Computer Link reminds me that I have to get my column in, I think. I'm probably next. All right. Microsoft said it will issue 12 security updates next week to patch 22 vulnerabilities in Internet Explorer, Windows, it's Internet Server, and Visio, their data diagramming tool. The company also acknowledged it will provide patches next Tuesday for three bugs it has already acknowledged, including one that has been exploited by criminals for several weeks. That's right. Microsoft has known for several weeks that your machines were vulnerable, and they're just now patching it. Of the three unpatched but admitted vulnerabilities, one is in IE, a second is in Windows rendering of thumbnail images, and the third is in IIS, the Internet Information Server, Microsoft's web server software. Microsoft acknowledged the IE bug on December after a French security firm issued a bare-bones advisory that said all versions of IE, including 2009's IE8, were vulnerable. Shortly after that, Microsoft warned users that attackers were exploiting the bug several weeks ago. The Windows flaw is in the graphics engine's rendering of thumbnail images inside folders. The bug was disclosed in mid-December 2010 at a South Korean security conference, and Microsoft published an advisory on January 4th. That would be over a month ago. At the time, the company said it would not release an emergency or out-of-band patch for the problem. Also in early January, Microsoft took the unusual step of listing the known bugs that it had yet to patch, detailing five unfixed flaws. Next week's updates will address three of those five.
Nice, Dave.
So they're only going to fix three of the five they know about. You're still vulnerable to two of them. One of them is the flaw in the MHTML, the MIME HTML protocol handler, that the company confirmed only last Friday. Security experts last week were unanimous in betting that the MHTML vulnerability would not be fixed in this month's round of updates. I feel bad for Microsoft. They clearly cannot afford enough programmers to work on more than, say, three fixes
three bugs at a time.
So if you're still using Windows, and especially if you're still using Internet Explorer in Windows, Microsoft is intentionally leaving you hanging in the breeze. So our question to you, how are you planning to keep your system safe in the face of Microsoft's admissions? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, I always recommend trying to keep as up-to-date as you can. And Microsoft, generally, if they think that a bug needs to be patched immediately, they'll do what's called an out-of-cycle update. Usually it's whatever, which Tuesday of the month is it that they usually...
Second Tuesday.
Second Tuesday of the month they usually deploy their Patch Tuesday patches to everyone. And if they think something is especially notorious, they will do an out-of-phase patch. They'll say, people need to get this patch as quickly as possible, and they'll make that available. But it sounds like that none of these quite made to that threshold of being...
Now, I do understand. I mean, I do really understand that they have to be thoroughly tested.
True, yes.
You know,
because breaking something is even worse.
Right. I do get that. But seriously, 5 weeks? 5 weeks? 5 weeks?
Does seem like a long time.
It does, doesn't it?
That's a tenth of a year, right? 52 weeks in a year?
That's exactly right. And you say a tenth of a year, it really sounds worse, doesn't it? They haven't fixed this in a tenth of a year.
We got our first IM. As you know, here at Jazz 90.1, that you can now text us if you've got a question of that. And, you know, if you dial 585-209-9010, you can text us with your questions also. I'll try to get to them as fast as I can. But Galloway 81, and Nick, this would probably be for you. Is there a place to find contact information for Altoona Lug, where the website apparently is down?
What?
Altoona Linux Users Group?
Yeah.
The Altoona Lug.
Yep. The Altoona Lug. He says evidently the website is apparently down. Any other suggestions for... And this listener is listening to us on the web.
So probably over in Pennsylvania, I suspect.
Yep. Altoona, Pennsylvania.
I'll put that down as the thing. That's a very good question. AltoonaLug.org. Is the domain name is not, in fact, registered.
Yeah.
So it looks like the Altoona Lug is in fact, down. Or they've moved, and Google hasn't caught up with them, because Google still lists the AltoonaLug.org as the place to go. Unfortunately... as I said, Whois tells me that the domain name is not, in fact, registered. So if anybody from the Altoona Lug is listening and would like to call in and let us know what the heck is going on with the Altoona Linux Users Group, we'd be delighted to hear that. Lug is short, of course, for Linux Users Group. So
right.
We'd be delighted to hear that.
And like I was saying before, though, this is another way that Rob has put up for you folks to get a hold of us. I mean, you know, we've got emailing. You can call us in. Normally we have the stream going. But for anything on Jazz 90.1, you know, during the day, if you're hearing a particular song or want to know one or request something, you can now text it from your phone. And again, you know, give it a shot and see what it's like. It's 585-209-9010. Give it a try.
Yep, it's pretty cool. We're doing a lot of interesting stuff now. We've got what were we talking about before? We got interrupted in that because we never finished.
With the Microsoft patches.
Oh yeah, Microsoft. I don't remember. Dave interrupted us, and I can't remember what we were in the middle of saying. Well, Dave, I mean, you know, I can see how much more important that was than what we were saying. So, clearly it was. So,
patch Tuesday.
I apologize. I don't remember what we were saying. It doesn't matter.
Out of band patches and things breaking and needing to be tested, but still it was a tenth of a year.
Yeah. All right. Whatever it was, it's gone now. It's clearly not important. You can give us a call. Don't forget at 585-966-JAZZ, 966-5299. Or toll free at 1-800-790-0415. I apologize that we lost that train of thought, but hopefully we'll have an entirely different one shortly. I really don't remember what it was we were talking about. I apologize to everyone out there who was actually listening to that conversation, which clearly Dave was not. Our next caller is Michael from Penfield, New York. Welcome, Michael. What's your question?
Hello. How are you today?
Peachy, how are you?
Good. I'm having trouble with my clock time going slow. Using Windows XP, it's not the battery. I've changed the battery. And it'll start losing time sometimes 15, 20 minutes during the day. I've got PC tools run the registry. I can't figure out what's causing it. If I reboot the machine, the time goes back to normal, and it will stay for couple days, and then it starts going slow again.
So if you reboot the system, the time is correct again.
That's right. I also have one of these atomic clock things that, you know, you ping it and it resets the time, but once it starts going slow, it starts slowing.
What OS was it?
Set XP.
Okay.
Windows XP.
Service Pack 3?
Yes.
Okay. Actually, when was the last time you danced the security tango?
Well, I haven't done that.
Yeah.
Might be time.
This is actually a fairly common problem with a lot of spyware and malware installed. That's typically because the number of running processes slow down the overall clock speed. They don't slow the clock speed down, but they take over the system to the point where nothing else can get in its little ticks.
Right, but I've got spyware software I run. I've got malware software I run. I've got virus software I run. I haven't found anything in there.
No, I understand that. But let me suggest that you dance the security tango because what software are you running? What's your antivirus software?
I think for antivirus, it's free AVG.
Well, that's a good one, but I would suggest dancing the tango so that you reboot into to safe mode and all the other stuff that's in the tango, because there are a lot of them nowadays that hide from the operating system. In fact, there are a few that can only be fixed by taking the drive out and cleaning it from another system where you don't boot it. But the tango is about the best you can do without pulling the drive itself, and I would suggest you do that.
Okay, I'll try that.
Yeah, I'm sorry you did a great job in troubleshooting this. You changed the battery, that didn't solve the problem. Rebooting fixes the time, so we know the battery is working. Updating internet time, we know that that works. So the only thing it is the internal software clock of Windows is slow, and the main reason that happens is because of viruses that are taking over its clock cycles.
Clock speed, yeah. Something else running. Make sure, another thing that I've been seeing, and this goes for all our listeners, is a lot of them also like to sneak into what they call the scheduled task. If you go into, whether it's Windows 98, XP, even Windows 7, you can go into the control panel and look at the scheduled task, you know, the scheduled tasks that are supposed to run. A lot of them are putting themselves in there and they're telling it to run, every hour on the hour, and it can literally slow your machine down and take over your machine. So give that a look. It's well worth the investigation, and delete them. If they're in there and you don't need those services running all the time, unless it's a backup type of scheduled thing, then sure. Go with that.
Okay. All right. I'll try that too. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you. We are... the problem is with a lot of these, it requires a lot of troubleshooting. But in this particular case,
Michael did a great job. Yeah, I'm impressed.
Yeah, he really did. He picked up all the variables that it could be,
mm-hmm.
and eliminated all the ones he knew about.
Right, systematically.
And then he called us, and that's very impressive, Michael.
We don't usually get that.
Yeah, we don't usually get that. As a matter of fact, and that's great. We'll take any question, of course. Not everybody is a troubleshooter, and that's fair. So we'll take whatever, but the reality is that was really nice.
Well,
to hear that from
me. As a matter of fact, the Jay Galloway 81 is saying he's got the same problem running Linux Mint 10
with slow clock.
But yeah. in his case, it's more likely to be a battery.
Could be.
I mean, Linux doesn't have the same kind of problems with.
Well, the other thing too is, you know, even though he changed the battery, you know, and he seems to be doing the scans on it. The other thing is there's also an internal battery chip, you know, on the motherboards.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be going too, depending on the age of the machine.
Right. I've seen them last 10 years, and I've seen them last 3 years. Mm-hmm. So
they can go.
It doesn't really depend on how often you're using it or anything else. It's just like it's literally a watch battery, you know, when you think about it. It's
right,
just keeping
it
track
is.
Of the date and time mm-hmm. until it goes dead.
And right. all the BIOS information and everything else.
Right.
So I know one person I know for Galloway, one person I know had a problem where she had the wrong time zone and the system kept trying to correct it. But it was very weird. It was slowing down to catch up, and when we put the correct time zone in, it never had the problem again. I would not have credited that as a legitimate answer, but
it's Windows.
You know what? It worked. No, in this case, it was Linux.
Really?
And it worked. And I don't
well, it's just like sometimes
it.
With Windows, back with Windows 98 and first with Service Pack 1 with XP, I would have trouble holding on to the work group. And literally all you had to do was go in, edit the work group, change one letter on it, reboot the machine, change it back to what you want,
mm-hmm.
reboot, and it fixed it.
Who knows? Who knows what the heck these programmers are smoking?
Yeah, I mean, hello, you know, they probably have some good parties there at Microsoft and, you know, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, let's do this. Yeah, that'll work.
One of the things that I suggest people do is actually set up in Linux it's called a cron job. In Windows it's an AT job or a timed job,
mm-hmm.
Where you every maybe once a day you call the program that sets the date and time.
Okay.
And then, you know, that goes out to an internet site, to one of the timers, to the time sync clocks on the internet,
right,
and time and sets the system time from that.
Yeah, and that works really well for a lot of people, especially people whose battery's gone dead and they just don't want to be bothered to open the case and have to hunt for it and head over to their favorite store and
right.
and replace it. That's a good way to mask the problem.
Right. All right. It doesn't solve the problem, but it solves the symptom, which is, you know, for many, in this particular case, it's not a big deal one way or the other. We are going to take a quick break, back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Dennis Wurster, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour, and we are Soundbites right here on the great member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Dennis Worster.
And at 2 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. We have Gil from Webster, New York on the line. Welcome, Gil. What's your question?
Well, actually, I had a comment and sort of another comment. So the comment was, I was wondering when I heard the fellow with the clock problem say, oh, well, I have one of these atomic mumble-mumble clocks. And I thought to myself, maybe he's got two programs. One of them is trying to retard the clock to get it back to, maybe the wrong time zone or maybe daylight versus whatever. And another clock program maybe that runs less frequently or it could be something, two things fighting each other. When he boots the machine, it sets the clock to the correct time, and then periodically his atomic thing could be basically trying to retard the clock to get it back to an hour earlier or who knows what the heck. So.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, that's
an excellent point,
possible.
Gil. Thank you.
It's a thought. The other point was you seem to be on the subject of, I'll sort of generalize it to people programming their devices, including computers, phones, what the heck else. So,
right.
There have been all these attempts over the years to make programming languages that people can deal with, and usually one of the methods is to basically make it application specific. So I'll cite something like Excel, which is, or any of the spreadsheet programs,
right,
all
right,
the way
right,
back
right.
down to what was it, VisiCalc or whatever mm-hmm. it was way back when.
Yep. Right.
I mean, the idea was we're going to give you a metaphor for programming, and we're going to simplify it. It's like a hand calculator, and you have so many buttons, and you can only push these things and so forth. So it makes it easy to learn, easy to conceptualize, and you can turn your problems into something that you can solve on your hand calculator or your Excel or your RPG or you who knows what. I mean, I've even seen BASIC adapted to programming games where the BASIC environment has, scenery kinds of stuff built into it and icons and all sorts of, little sprites and who knows what. So you can create a game device on your computer using a sort of specialized form of BASIC. So I guess the question I have, and, maybe it's a future question on your poll, is, are people really, how interested are people in investing, the time it takes to learn these kinds of things to, Excel is a learning curve, but calculator is a learning curve. People have accepted those, but how much are they really interested in learning the stuff it takes to really actually write a program, to program your phone, for example, and
right.
How specialized would it have to be before you'd actually, be willing to spend the effort to learn how to program your phone if you had to, spend a couple of days reading a few manuals and practice for a couple of weeks. Is that too much? Or?
Well, and that's a lovely question. If people who want to answer that, they should call us, and we'll be glad to talk about that. I love the idea. Yeah, I think what you're going to find, though, Gil, is that you're going to have a spectrum. At one end are people who just want to use the thing and shut up and let me use it.
Right. Dispassionate users.
Right. At the other end are the people who want to do nothing but program it. But most people, I think, fall in the middle. If I needed a real quick X, I'd love to be able to create that if it was easy enough.
Well, one of the tricks that they've done, in Excel did this, a whole bunch of languages, and scripting languages and whatever mm-hmm. else sort of do this, and that is if you need to learn to program C or C++ or C# or whatever, and or even, you know, there are, you know, a million other programming languages. Typically what you do is write a program, and then you have to have this big environment, and you compile it, and you have libraries.
Right.
The infrastructure is just overbearing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and anybody wanting to learn that has to be really serious and or crazy and or just plain out of it. I mean, you know, having done that myself, you know, over the years, it's just not a user-friendly thing to do. Whereas, take something like a calculator, you don't need anything other than, you know, the calculator, your hand, a little common sense, maybe some instruction, or Excel is basically the same
other,
way.
So, other engineers have made some decisions for you and taken those components away and given you kind of a set of guidelines and guardrails to keep you protected from going off into the weeds. You have that that level of protection.
Right. All right. Thanks, Gil.
Okay. Take care. Have
we
fun.
Appreciate it. Keep smiling. Interesting point. If anybody else would like to talk about that point, please do. We have another caller. Oh, no, we don't. Apparently not.
I was thinking about...
We're working on that.
Dovetailing that conversation into training, you know, corporate training or learning things in school and... And just the tools that exist now that didn't used to exist, even just since the explosion of the internet, there are websites where you can get tutorials online for things. You can see things in a lot of different ways. If you are the kind of person that learns best by following along a set of directions, there's that. But there's also people who make videos of themselves talking about things and building it on the fly and saying, I did the following here, and here's why I did it, and here's how you might change it if you wanted to. There are great tools online for that. One of the best I can think of is lynda.com that does screencasts on hundreds of different pieces of software. So if there's something you want to learn, I mean, that's a great place to go.
It's a great place to go.
And in fact, we'll be talking about that more on Wednesday at the CIDR meeting.
And where and when is that CIDR meeting?
Once again, the CIDR meeting will be at East High on Wednesday night at 7 p.m. We do encourage everybody and anyone to come and join us and see what's new in the Apple world, but not only just that, but just in the computer world in general.
Perfect. Our next caller is Al from Penfield, New York. Welcome, Al. What's your question?
Hey, guys.
Hi, Al. How are you?
Long time.
Yes, it has been.
Well, it's interesting. Your topics of your conversation sort of spin around the same area I'm interested in and the reason I'm calling. I was originally going to call and just say I'm looking around. I've got a little more free time in my schedule, and I was interested in if there's any user groups flying around for Photoshop elements and Photoshop Premiere type use.
Yep. I can tell you for certain that we have definitely covered Photoshop elements at the Apple user group a couple of different times, and that there are users that make use of it primarily on the Mac, but I'm sure that a lot of the things you do with elements cover many different platforms. So if there's questions you have or things you want to learn, or you just want to talk with people about Photoshop Elements and things you've done with it or things you want to do, that the Apple CIDR user group would be a great place to come and join.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Because, I looked up a listing in locally of all the different user groups, and I see some familiar names from, let's say, 25 years ago.
Yeah, right.
A while.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a fairly current list of them at rockwiki.org.
Yep, and there's one at techny.com.
Yep. Sure, yep, that's another one.
Okay, good. Now, just because this sort of segues together so well with the previous user's comment and what you guys have been talking about, I'd make the observation regarding people learning applications and programming languages and developing their own applications.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the learning, as I think everyone's described in various ways, the learning curve is often the biggest hurdle. I've got to sit down and... cogitate on this for like a month before I can do anything of the most simplest nature is probably going to turn a lot of people off.
Right.
That really the way in is to offer somebody a chance to, you can build some simple things quickly, and that'll get you started and show you the reason for investing more time and becoming more proficient.
Sure.
Well, why do people use web languages like PHP and Ruby on Rails? They're easy to get started in. Maybe difficult to dig into, but to get started in, to build simple things, to build fast and easy, They're not bad for that.
Or to customize something you've seen somewhere else.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
And HTML was almost the classic example of that back in the early days when you had your Netscape browser and you found a web page and you said, ooh, they just did this really cool thing. How do I do that?
Right.
You know, you looked at the source and poof,
that's how we all learned. Right. And HyperCard really was a fairly simple way to design a database. You just told it what the database had to look like. You designed your forms, and all the rest was magic in the background.
Right.
And that was really useful for so many things. And, of course, you didn't have to do databases because it had hooks into the operating system. You know, if you wanted to open a window or play a song or whatever, that was all just click, 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 and you could do it. It was really a terrific product for the casual programmer.
Sure.
Remember old DBase?
I remember DBase. Oh. I made a living off of DBase.
Yeah.
Not fondly.
Yeah, it is fondly. Yeah, well, the money I was fond of, yes.
However, and one trip down memory lane, and I'll let you go. But so from DBase, I went into Paradox.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Now, they haven't made Paradox in 15 years or so.
Yeah,
I think I'm too young for this conversation.
It's fast, it's functional, and it gets the job done.
Cool. Exactly. That is exactly right.
We did get a comment from a listener that mentioned that something like Python is a tool that is easy to pick up, that's relatively straightforward, doesn't have a lot of weird jargon associated with it, and I tend to agree. I spent an afternoon with it once, and other people I know have made good use of it. I think it's a great tool and easy to learn. It's still, from my experience, it's still based in the, you know, the character world. It's not graphical, at least the part of it that I did, but I could recommend that as something if you just wanted to get to the idea of, you know, variables and looping and
right.
And you know, all the miscellaneous gymnastics that you can make a small program do, then Python might be a good choice to check into.
Yep, it would. All right, thanks, Al.
Thanks, guys.
Have fun. I suppose if you're going to use any language other than APL. You ever seen APL? It's all symbols.
No.
It's a math language, and it's all symbols.
Okay.
You get like a line of 20 symbols, and it's just a huge, gigantic program that, you know, inverts matrices and multiplies them. You know, it's just very weird. It's
right.
Very, very cool language.
This is great. We're getting so many calls today.
Yeah, we are. Our next caller is Vic from Irondequoit. Welcome, Vic. What's your question?
I just got a little window that opened up. It says HP update. An update is available. We'd like to download and install this update. Well, there's no place to click on. I mean, I can move the window anywhere I want, but there's nothing that I can click on it.
It sounds like your best bet. Do me a favor and reboot, and see what happens when you reboot. If not, either. Now, were you on a web page when you got this?
No, I just started up.
All right, reboot and see if there's a if it comes back the same way. If it does, I don't really have an answer for you. There's nothing you can do except close that window and move on.
Okay, well, I can't close it. There's nothing to click on. I mean, there's nothing to do. I can just, like, stick it under my system tray.
There's no little X anywhere
on the
corner?
Yeah, yeah, that's... I would reboot. Although, so it's likely that it's either just a bad...
bad draw.
Draw from, yeah, from the boot up process. So I would reboot. It should clear up the problem. If it doesn't, then you got to talk to somebody at HP because I don't even know how you would fix that.
Okay, I mean, one other question.
Yeah.
I've got a verbatim flash drive, and I plugged it in my Windows 7 computer, and it recognizes it, but when I click on it, it won't let me open it up.
What error message do you get?
I don't get any. I click on it, it says vSafe 100 Avista. That's the it's password protected. And the little circle goes around like it's trying to open up, and then it stops, and that's it. Now, I have other verbatim flash drives that open up no problem. This one's only a couple years old.
Well, a couple years is a long time, and particularly if it's been banged around a little bit. What it sounds like, if other ones work in that same slot.
Yeah.
Then the likelihood is that the flash drive itself is where the problem lies.
Wow, a couple of years. That's amazing, isn't it? Or is that just the norm?
Now, I'd say that's lower than average.
Yeah.
That's on the low end of normal, but it depends on a number of different things. Heat and cold factors, if it's accidentally gone through the dryer a couple of times. if it's been exposed to warm, moist environments and then cold.
I've got some flash drives that are 5 years old. I've lost some flash drives after 3 years. It's the luck of the draw, you know. The average life expectancy is 5 years, which means some are going to die in 10 and some are going to die in 1.
Is there a tool, guys, in Windows that will just list all the drives other than Windows Explorer that he could go in and attempt to format it? Some, like a disk tools?
Yeah, you can go. Yeah, you can go into the control panel under what is it? Computer management. Drawing a brain fart right now. But yes, you can go in there and see the actual hard drives, because quite often when you put a new hard drive in, it won't show up. So you've got to go in under the system tools, look at the various hard drives, and that's where you would format it.
Right.
And you can also assign it drive letters. So I had that in a couple clients where now with these card readers, they assign all these drive letters.
Mm. Oh, right. Yeah.
Well, the client already had some of these letters that it wanted to assign mapped out to different drives. So I had to go in and change the card reader to map it to different drive letters. So I just drove it down into the bottom of the
alphabet, right?
The alphabet. Yeah. And they were back up in
hand. The other thing you might try is SpinWrite. The latest version of SpinWrite actually works with USB drives.
Uh-huh.
So it can't hurt to give it a shot. See what happens.
It is Gibson's thing, right?
Right, yep. GRC.com.
Yeah. Okay, I'll try that.
Yeah, that's the only other thing I can suggest, but it might work.
I'll give it a try. Thank you.
Let us know.
Yep.
All right, if I can, just for 1 second here. Steve... Steve, who's listening, Steve Ray.
Hey, Steve.
Evidently, he's slowed down or holding up in some place. Said Hyper Studio is a current incarnation of HyperCard.
That's true.
And he's got a webpage here that's www.mackiev.com.
Mackiev, yep.
/ Hyper Studio. It was written by Roger Wagner, 25 years of Apple program. He goes, Nick, you would probably remember that guy.
I remember him.
Yeah, Hyper Studio is great. When my high school, and this was in the early 90s, was looking for a replacement for HyperCard, Hyper Studio was what they went to. And before PowerPoint kind of became the sort of project app of choice for K-12 schools, HyperStudio was the kind of thing that we were developing multimedia presentations on way back when. And I think it's a great tool. It's very easy to pick up. Students seem to understand it. It offered color, which HyperCard didn't, I think, until its very last version.
HyperStudio does have both Windows and Mac versions.
Right. Huh. You know, you'd graduate from KidPix to HyperStudio.
Nothing for Linux.
Well, you can't have everything, but
yes, yes, you can.
You can't. Where would you put it?
Everywhere. You already have everything.
I guess. No, Steve's right though. HyperStudio is a great tool.
And one other thing he said is, in capital letters, do not use SpinWrite on a flash drive. Only magnetic drives.
Okay.
No, according to the Gibson website. It works, but I don't know. I haven't tried it myself.
All right. Sounds like we've got another caller.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, Steve. That was Steve from Victor, New York, where he's at his shop today. Our next caller is Ed from Ithaca. Welcome, Ed. What's your question?
Thank you. I have an IBM ThinkPad XP, and I have a Avast. Unfortunately, Avast keeps going to check for updates every time I plug my computer into the internet, which I do a few times a day. And I would like to change the adjustments, but I can't find Avast on the computer. I did Revo to uninstall it and then reinstall it. It still doesn't show up under my programs.
Hmm.
All right, listen, hang on to the line. We have to take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll answer your question. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Dennis Worster, me, Nick Francesco. Ed is on the line. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And at 25 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And we have Ed on the line. Ed, are you there? Oh, no. Is Ed there?
Mm-hmm. I'm here.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
You only connect to the internet, what, once every 4 or 5 hours?
Right.
Yeah. Well, and that's why. Avast actually updates every 4 hours.
Oh.
And in the free version, you can't change that.
I see.
But let it run through. The theory here is that you've got an update that wasn't finished. And it's telling you, let me finish.
Uh-huh.
So let it update and see what happens. But it does update, and it's usually kind of in the background. You shouldn't necessarily be seeing anything unless you're specifically looking for it.
I'm not seeing anything, but it's slowing down my internet connection, which is not a fast connection anyway.
Right. And that's why it does check every 4 hours.
Okay. It does say that its virus update has been checked.
Right. And that's actually normal behavior, and it's not something you can change.
Okay.
But it does connect every 4 hours.
Okay. Any sense of why I can't find it on my computer?
Find Avast?
Yeah, it's not under my programs.
Really?
You could go to, if you go to the Windows Explorer, I think the default location, from what I'm able to understand, is in Program Files and then LWIL Software. And then inside there should be Avast.
What? Program Files and then what?
LWIL, ALWIL.
Which also begs to wonder if he's...
No, it should be under LWIL Software.
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is if it's not showing up, which it should, whether he's got a rootkit issue. Something, you know, because some of these rootkits will literally shut down the antivirus software.
Right, but it's updating. Well, at any rate, you should definitely dance the security tango to see if you've gotten caught by something, but... you should find it under Avast or LWIL Software on your system. And if you're not, that's a little worrisome. So dance the tango and see what happens.
Okay, thank you. Do you have time for one quick question?
Very quick.
When I take my laptop out in the winter, it gets very cold.
That's normal because it's cold outside.
Sounds about right.
Let it warm up before I turn it on after coming inside?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I'd recommend that.
Mm-hmm.
I would get up to room temperature.
Yeah.
Especially if it's got a spinning hard drive in it, which 95% of all laptops do these days.
Yep. Yeah. It's always a good idea to let your electronics warm up to room temperature. I have seen people have a real problem with their phones as well. My suggestion is always, on days like this, if you're, you know, during the winter, if you're going to be outside any significant amount of time, you keep your phone in a pocket and not in a, you know, a pouch on your belt or on a,
purse. Or,
yeah, like, no.
Right? Or in your purse or in a jacket pocket, you keep it closer to your body where your body can warm it up a little bit. Otherwise, you could do some damage to it.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly since they randomly will turn, like if you get a phone call. And the thing has gotten down
so
below
cold,
its
right.
operating temperature, and suddenly you get a phone call, you can kill your phone.
Yep. I know my iPod is like that. I've got an old school iPod that has a battery in it, and if I accidentally leave it in the car while I'm at a job and come back and want to listen to something while I'm in the car,
it'll
just say, nope, I'm sorry, not enough power, I'm going to shut off now. And I'm like, well, the best you can do is put it in your pocket for a few miles and then try again.
Mine still does a lot of butt dialing.
Yeah. I don't know how it does butt dialing. You've got it in a pouch.
I got it in a pouch, and I hit the lock.
Okay.
And you should hit, unless, you know, when I'm carrying the computers, it unlocks it. But I still haven't been able to figure it out. And I get it even to a screen where there's nobody.
I can't tell you how many calls I've gotten from you.
I know. A few other folks have, too.
I'm not actually hearing conversations. I'm waiting for that one where I can, you know, record the conversation I'm listening to. But I do get butt dialed for you. But anyway, Ed, that's your that I think is your story. You definitely want to warm that up, and for those of you
definitely.
Who keep your phones in a pouch or in your coat pocket or in your purse, you really don't want to do that in this kind of weather if you're going to be out any significant amount of time. Okie doke.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a little tip from us: cold weather usage of your phone, how to keep it safe.
Right. Hey, Nick, I got a question for you. So let's say you're at home Tell me about your backup strategy. How are you keeping your data safe? Things like music, things, or even more important, family photos.
I have a server out on the web that I back everything up to at 3 a.m.
Okay.
So I use rsync.
Sure.
Which is a great program. The rsync program actually only copies the uncopied data, the newest stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's only it's magic, because even if it's like a part of a file, it only copies up the part of a file, so I use very little of my bandwidth.
Sure.
And I copy my stuff and my wife's stuff up to a server on the net.
Right.
And so now it's in those two places. I'm about to add a network drive, so I'll actually have it in three places.
Okay. Yeah, multiple places is always good.
Yeah, how about you?
I've got a couple of approaches. I've got a Mac at home. Luckily, since OS 10.5, Apple has included a great feature called Time Machine.
Right.
And that lets you make a duplicate backup of just about everything that's on your drive to an external drive. So that gives you a second copy. So then the next trick is to figure out what's important to you and get that out of your house. And you can do that either by burning it to a DVD and letting a friend hang on to it for a little while, or burning two DVDs and spreading it out to multiple friends.
Right.
Or a great tool that's free is Dropbox.
Right. Limited storage, though.
Limited storage for free. You can expand it for not too much more money. Money well spent, very easy to use. It literally makes a folder on your computer. You drag what you want to be in the Dropbox into it, and you can get to it on the web. You can get to it from your iPad or your iPhone.
Right.
Great tool for
Carbonite is very inexpensive and
true.
Works pretty well as
yep.
well.
If you want a automated backup, things like Carbonite, Mozy. There's another one out of Toronto called Kinetic D. That's a great tool. All of those are great and multi-platform, too, so you can back up a lot of stuff. The pricing tends to vary. Some places will charge you for how much you're storing there. Some places charge you for how much you're moving, you know, the bandwidth. Some places actually charge you for both. So shop around, find something that fits your budget. But, you know, we just, and I say this to all my clients, we don't have the negatives anymore for those family photos. They are literally
right.
irreplaceable. I had a client a couple of weeks ago brought me a laptop that wouldn't boot anymore. Turned out the hard drive was dead. It's used by their daughters, and there was only a certain amount of stuff I could get back. You know, I got back 20 megs out of a several dozen gigabyte drive, and that's the worst part of my job is when I have to hand that back and say, well, you know, I did what I could.
Yep.
But please, if you're listening to this, get a backup in place and make sure that you use it and test it every once in a while. Make sure it's doing its job.
See, and that's the big part. A lot of people don't test it.
Yep, it's true.
Every once in a while, I just go out and I pull back a file.
Sure.
And that tells me that file's good, so randomly, theoretically, would mean many of the files are good.
That's right.
All right, our next caller is Jim from Henrietta, New York. Welcome, Jim. What's your question?
Hi, guys. My father-in-law has a Windows XP computer. It's maybe 2 years old. It's pretty, you know, plenty of power for what he does, simple internet browsing stuff. But and I tried to set him up with, he's got an antivirus, he's got some anti-spyware tools, and I set him up so that he's only the, you know, not an administrator, and he still gets stuff installed over there. You know, he calls me up a lot often and says, and I don't mind helping him, of course, but, you know, he can't get on the internet because, you know, something's hijacked his browsers. I came over there one time and you know, even though it's a limited user, it's had a proxy installed, so I think everything he was typing was going through some other computer
yep.
address. So how do I keep his system clean? I think the only thing I could do is remove any, you know, I thought removing the administrator access would do it, but is there other things I should turn off, or what would you do?
Well, I would put him on Windows 7. And the reason is that Windows XP is a sieve, and Microsoft stopped updating and fixing it years ago. So what you did is right if XP worked the way it's supposed to. It doesn't, and there's nothing you can do to fix that. Moving him to Windows 7 means that all the things you've done should work fine.
Will that work on a two-year-old computer?
Depends on how fast it is and how much RAM it has and how much disk space it has. But theoretically, yes.
Does Microsoft make a compatibility tool?
Yeah, they do.
That you can download?
Yeah, I was just about to say there's a Microsoft compatibility tool, and I don't have it in my head, but...
And that what that'll do is you can download that and run it on your two-year-old machine, and it will say, you know, it'll check your video hardware, it'll check your storage, it'll check how much RAM you have and your processor and all those other components inside the box, and let you give you a report of what's just fine, what might need to be updated or enhanced, and you can take your machine to a shop and just get just that component enhanced and compare against buying a whole new machine. But that tool, you know, would be something to run that wouldn't cost you anything to at least see where you're at.
Right. If you know, if you were to go to Google and type in hardware compatibility list, Windows 7, the very first link is the actual
the tool.
Okay. The tool itself, or at least the link to the tool.
And then I should buy a 32-bit flavor?
Your
for
choice.
A two-year-old machine.
I like Yeah,
your choice, but it depends a lot on how much RAM you have. You really don't want a 64-bit version for less than 2 gigs of RAM.
Okay.
And for the stuff he's doing, I don't know, the 32-bit won't be fine.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Sure.
All right, I want to jump in here for a minute and remind folks, hey, you got to save a date, and that's March 12th. What am I talking about? It's the
we never know.
I don't sometimes. There's a party going on in my head tonight. Great times in there.
Can't get a word in edgewise.
Yeah. And I got to remind you folks, put down that date, March 12th, because it's going to be the first annual pancake breakfast. That's all the pancakes you can eat, sausage juice, and it's going to be from 10 to 2. And who's going to be going on there?
Well, oddly enough, it's from 10 to 1, actually, is the pancake breakfast. That's one we're serving. From 10 to noon, you will be able to listen to the mellifluous tones of Al and Ray on the polka bandstand. There'll be the polka show will be from 10 to noon.
Right.
And then,
but it's not only that.
More importantly, we think, from noon to 2, we'll be doing our show, Soundbites, live from the pancake breakfast. So, it's March 12th. We serve from 10 to 1, but you can stay till 2. You come in for $5. You get all the pancakes and sausages and juice that you want. You're going to listen to great polka music. You're going to see sound bites in all its glory. Kids 5 and under are free. It's in the cafeteria, so there's plenty of free parking and all kinds of other good stuff. And it's only $5. Proceeds go to help the station. You know this station. We are not. We don't get government funding. We don't get state funding. We don't get county funding. We don't get city funding. And every penny that we take in stays to support a local station. It doesn't go anywhere else. It stays in this community. We are the community that gets the benefit of the funds that come from this community.
And we got to remind you, folks, when you call and ask for tickets, or if you go on the web and order them that way, which you can do securely, trying to remind you folks, we got a little friendly competition going against with the polka dots, and we're trying to see who can get more listeners to come to this event. So if you're calling and you've or on the web, request that they put the yellow stripe on it that it is for sound bites. That way we get the credit and we can see if we can beat the polka dots. One other item I want to bring up is along with this and, you know, all this great food and entertainment for literally 4 hours. Rumor has it that Laurel Ann and Rob are going to have some giveaways. So it's just another reason that you want to come is here at Greece Olympia High School, right here on Maiden Lane, and it's in the cafeteria. So it's going to be a great time, a lot of parking, so that won't be an issue, and a lot of fun. So don't miss out on it.
Now, I realize that our podcast listeners from the UK and the Ukraine and Finland and Germany and Canada and Norway and all those places are probably not going to come to this breakfast.
Yeah, Why not?
The $5 probably won't cover shipping the pancakes.
Exactly. But if you are in Western New York or over the border, our neighbors to the north in Canada, just over the border, if people can come from Buffalo, then you can certainly come from Niagara Falls. Come on over. It's going to be, I think, a great, great day. It's going to be lots of fun. We'd love to see our listeners there. And, of course, the money goes to keeping this and all the great shows on the air on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Yep. I'm really looking forward to it. Plus, you know, I mean, we got an, if that wasn't enough, I'm going to slide one more in here, is, you know, that we're
doing. Wait, there's more.
Oh, yeah. No, we got another event that's coming up. And this, I want to remind folks that the 10th annual Small Business Home Office, which is called the Soho Show, is coming up to Rochester. It's going to be the 10th annual. And Nick, Steve, and I are going to be there personing the booth. And let's see if there's a date. Yes. No, I take that back. There's, I don't see a date here. Going to have to look into that. But it is coming up, the Soho Show. We are going to be there, and I'll hopefully have a little more information. I thought there was here. I apologize. Oh, wait a minute. Duh. Read a little farther, Enron. March 30th.
You can do it.
Dave's just kind of in his own head right now. And
there's a party going on.
We're just privileged listeners as whatever is in his head goes through it. All right.
Quitting while you're ahead, Dave.
Apparently we're going to take a break now. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with all of the Dave Enrights, Dennis Worcester, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 41 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to Sound Bites right here on the wonderful member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Dennis Worcester.
And in 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Hey, did you ever get the feeling that the itemized charges on your cell phone bill aren't quite right? A new class action lawsuit filed against AT&T claims that often they aren't, and the mistakes could be costing consumers millions. AT&T's iPhone data service is like a gas station that charges for a full gallon when it only pumps 9/10 of a gallon into your tank, according to a lawsuit filed late last week. The company overstates data downloads by 7 to 14%, which could lead to overage charges for consumers who aren't signed up for the iPhone's all-you-can-eat data plan, which I don't think there is one anymore.
Yeah, you had to get grandfathered in.
Yeah, right.
Although there are rumors that these kinds of things may be coming back now that the iPhone's available on Verizon as well as AT&T.
But nobody's doing real all-you-can-eat anymore.
No, it's not
you
quite.
All-you-can-eat is really like 5 gigs.
It's 5 gigs, and either then they charge you more or they throttle you down to some ridiculous bandwidth.
Exactly.
Because they can, and there's no really good reason for it.
Right.
They're just money hungry.
The suit filed Thursday in federal court in the Northern District of California also claims that AT&T sometimes charges consumers for entirely phantom downloads, ringing up charges even when the phone's internet connection is off. The lawsuit compares this to a rigged gas pump charging you for when you never even pulled up your car into the station. And it claims that the firm's billing software is so out of whack that it incorrectly logs the date and time of data connections, causing some to appear in the wrong month's billing cycle, which could also lead to overcharging. AT&T said that accurate billing is a priority for the firm, and it intends to vigorously defend itself against the lawsuit. In fact, we've created tools that let our customers check their voice and data usage at any time, yada, yada, yada. The lawsuit seeks both federal and California class action status. As proof of unfair practices, attorneys for the plaintiff said they hired an independent consulting firm to run tests on iPhone data downloads. In one case, the firm found a 50 KB website was logged as a 53.5 KB website. In another case, the consultant purchased a brand new phone, turned off all services, and was still billed for 35 data transactions, totaling 2,292K, that's 2 meg, of usage.
Hey, you know, like I say, you know, it's right up there with the government and their surcharges.
Right.
They add all these other charges and hidden costs for this connection and that connection, and you sit there and go, huh?
A friend of mine was complaining the other day. She looked at her bill, and there's a charge for, I forget what it is, but it's a charge to send her a bill.
Yeah.
They add on a charge to send her a bill. Whether you get that bill on paper or electronically, they charge you for the privilege of getting a bill. So don't send me a bill.
Yeah.
I'm happy if they don't send me a bill.
Give it to me for free.
Right.
Then they'll enroll you in the service for electronic billing for only $1.99 a month.
They charge you to send you an electronic bill, like, or they charge you to send you a paper bill.
It's like paying to get an unlisted phone number.
What if I were to charge them to write them a check?
Yeah, see how that flies.
Exactly. Anyway, how closely
if you don't
do you
like
check
it,
your...
Start your own phone company is what
that's
they say.
Exactly right. How closely do you check your phone bill? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll free at 1-800-790-0415. 1-5. I don't check my phone bill. I check it semi closely. I mean, I don't. I'm just disgusted by them all anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you get there. Well, any of the bills, you know, for various services, you look at it. Well, the other one that ticks me off is when I, you know, people, and I use it too, credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here's the other thing. These folks that get, you know, these reward points and all this other stuff. You know what?
It's got to come from somewhere.
As a merchant, you know, the banks aren't giving that to you, folks. The places that you wind up charging has to pay an extra fee. And it's, matter of fact, only pennies, but it's extra pennies that I sit there and I'm paying for your rewards card. But if I go ahead and up my rates to, you know, subsidize that, they'll cancel the credit card.
Right.
So the banks, you know, as a merchant, and the privilege of accepting credit cards, you have to also take on their programs, and you can't charge extra for it.
Yeah.
So I'm literally, and all the other merchants, when you swipe your mileage card or these money back, it's not, you're literally getting the other.
There's a new company called Square.
I was just going to mention this.
At squareup.com.
I've got the reader in the other room. I can show it to you later.
You
got to
see this reader. It's this little reader. It plugs into an iPhone or an Android phone or an iPad or an iTouch.
It's about the size of a postage stamp.
And you swipe the credit card. They take 3% and nothing else.
And there's no monthlies or anything else.
There's nothing. Let's 3%
talk about this
and
later.
You're done.
Yeah.
It's squareup.com. The reader is free. You just sign up with the service. Every time you swipe your card.
My clients love it.
You're done.
Especially if I go to do an on-site thing and they want to pay me right away, so I don't. I'll send them like a PDF invoice.
This would be the one reason you'd get a smartphone, and that's because you may be somewhere where there's no internet
and
access.
And it would work on your touch, too. You still got your touch?
Oh, yeah.
It'll work on the touch if you've got to have internet access. So
most
if you're
of my clients say
right,
do.
Right. So you don't really, but you know, that would be the one thing that would turn you into doing this. Swipe the card right there.
I'll show it to you.
They get 3%,
yeah.
You get the rest, you win,
love
you're done.
Look, yeah, so, I'd like to look at that.
Yeah, it's a very cool product.
Very much.
Very cool product. I've been.
Now,
with getting one
and then they charge you the monthly.
No, monthly fee.
No,
3% per transaction. Now you're done.
Yep, they put the money in your account the next day. You
Sweet.
Tell them what bank account to put it in.
They essentially get 3% plus a 24-hour float.
Yeah,
right.
But there's no other fee. Okay, I can live with that.
So, yeah, because I'm getting the monthly processing fee along with.
Yep.
You know, in that is those extra charges and dings for paying for those.
Yeah.
The incentive programs.
Stuff. Yep. This has been really great, especially for people who are starting up their own business. You know, they've been laid off and they're trying to do something new. So there are places that have a lawn care business where they're mowing lawns or raking or washing your dog. And, you know, you want to pay them right away, but you might not have the cash to do it. This lets them accept those credit card payments. You can also set up, I think, recurring charges if you need to. But, you know, it's a great
tool.
I'm
surprised we're not seeing more people with it at public market.
To be honest, that's the place I'd expect it to get really popular very fast.
Yep. And it's just a regular swiper, right? It's not our fit. It's an actual.
Nope. It's a real mag stripe.
Swipe it.
Yeah.
Right through this mag stripe. It's just, it's so cool.
And it's relatively secure. I never see the number. You know, it just treats it as a swiped transaction.
Now, what do you do as far as inside the, say, your business?
You can use it there too. Who cares?
Yeah. No, do they have a machine, though, that you can swipe it there?
No.
No.
You do it right off the same thing. How much do you pay for your machine? You buy a low end iPod Touch. You're done.
Right. Yeah. As long as you've got Wi-Fi in the shop, which I'm.
Yeah.
Probably
you're done.
Probably do. Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
No! It's
kind
of. I think a lot of these places that charge you all these additional fees are going to be in trouble.
Try that out for
on.
A while and just.
Right.
And there's no contract or anything.
Right, so you can just try it. If you like it, you got it. If you don't like it, you toss it, and you're done.
Yeah.
You're done.
Just think about it.
Oh, yeah. No, I want to learn more about this.
All right.
Yeah, it's a very cool thing. It's a very cool thing. We'll see what that all means, but that's the way that works. All right, have I got time for another?
Yeah, you got about, let's see, 2 minutes.
This is one of my favorites. For the second time in less than 6 months, two influential U.S. congressmen have sent a letter to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg questioning the social network's data sharing practices. The latest letter from U.S. Representatives Edward Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Joe Barton, Republican of Texas, was prompted by Facebook's plan to make the addresses and mobile numbers of its users available to third parties. Yes, your address and your phone number available to third parties, which we know means advertisers.
What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly. The feature, unveiled in January, aims to let external application developers and publishers access the full physical address and mobile phone numbers of Facebook users, although only with their permission.
Yeah.
Well. Facebook withdrew the feature a few days later amid, let's call them, privacy concerns. The company said it plans to relaunch in a few weeks after some updates. In their later letter dated February 2nd, Markey and Barton, co-chairmen of the House Bipartisan Privacy Caucus, which sounds like a great idea, asked Zuckerberg's nearly a dozen questions related to the proposed rollout. So we'll see what that has to do with it. So, you know, I've taken all my private information off of Facebook. It doesn't have my phone number. It doesn't have my address.
Well, like we were talking about that Spokio, too.
Yep.
Spokeo.com. And that's got a lot of information there, too, that you just probably don't want, and you can get out of it.
Yep.
I mean, Steve put the link up there. But, yeah, you can opt to go down to privacy issues at the bottom of that screen, and you can paste the URL in there and opt out of that. Again, it's posting a lot of personal information. TMI.
Yep.
Yeah, that is the truth. And don't forget, soundbites.org/map, and you will see a map of all our callers and where they've called from.
Yeah, I checked that out last night. It was really interesting to be able to see.
It's live, so every time, you know, I add somebody as they call in, it updates automatically.
That's really cool.
It's actually pretty cool. We've got a lot of callers across the United States and all over the world. Hawaii, Australia, Beijing, China, Canada. It's very cool. That's exactly right. That's people who have actively called into the show. All right, we're done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. We appreciate it. And please don't forget the pancake breakfast. Make sure you tell them it's for Sound Bites. Put that yellow stripe on the ticket when you call in. Tell them to do that. If you do it from the web, put it in the comments. We'll be back next week with Dave Enright, probably Steve Ray, although Dennis did a magnificent job this week. I'm Nick Francesco. And we want to thank you for listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.